On September 28th, the Global Citizen Festival will gather thousands of people who took action to end extreme poverty. Join Post Malone, Doja Cat, Lisa, Jelly Roll, and Rauw Alejandro as they take the stage with world leaders and activists to defeat poverty, defend the planet, and demand equity. Download the Global Citizen app today and earn your spot at the festival. Learn more at globalcitizen.org/vox.
Welcome to Switched on Pop. I am producer Rihanna Cruz.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
And welcome back to The Newcomers, our series where we talk to and about artists with new music that you should be listening to. And today, Nate, I'm here to tell you about an artist that has been around for a bit, but is a newcomer in the sense that he is trying out a brand new sound. Mm. He broke out as a teenager into the EDM scene, signing with Skrillex's label when he was 18. He landed on Billboard's list of 21 under 21 in 2012, then spent the next decade putting out three widely acclaimed EDM albums. But this year, he's pivoting in a big way. And with this new sound, he puts himself firmly in pop music, through and through. That artist is Porter Robinson with his new record, Smile, and that's Smile in all caps with an exclamation point and a happy smiling emoticon.
We love typography here, so good to know.
Here's his song, Cheerleader.
This is a cool finale for this series, Rihanna. I mean, Porter Robinson is someone, when I hear their name, I think of these, like, bash your fist in the air, headbanging, EDM builds and drops, Electric Daisy Carnival, furry boots and glow sticks kind of vibe. But with this track, as you said, I'm getting more of a pop smash sensibility. We've got these super singable, catchy melodies. We've got a proper chorus. We've got some counter melodies in the synth. I mean, the textures are still EDM, but the sound is pop.
Right, right. That synth line is so massive and nuts.
Very cool.
Love it. And it's different from anything Porter Robinson has done before. I think you could break up his career into four distinct eras. First, his debut record, Worlds, in 2014, was that festival-filling, melodic EDM, glow stick music. Here's the song Divinity off of that record.
That drop is seismic. That caused a tectonic shift when I heard that.
The way I could describe most of his music is massive. After Worlds, he put out my personal favorite project of his. It's a trance house electronic kind of Eurodance hybrid under the alias Virtual Self. Here's the track off of that, Ghost Voices.
This is fun to listen to because I feel like it takes all these tropes of electronic dance music and kind of mashes them together. We've got another one of those world-conquering drops with that massive sound you were describing. But then there's also kind of this like shuffly house beat going on. We've got some vocal chops as well, kind of out of the world of hip-hop production. So yeah, this is a real blend of different types of electronic music and somehow it all works.
And then in 2021, Porter put out his critically acclaimed album, Nurture, which starts to blend that signature electronic sound with the structure and the melodies of pop, kind of like putting his foot on the gas of pop music a little bit. Here's the song Musician off of Nurture.
okay, there is that pop sensibility kicking in. We've got this catchy chorus. We've got a singable melody you can follow along to. The EDM touches are still there, but it's definitely more interested in capturing your attention on the radio dial than getting you to go ham in a club.
Right, but Porter's New Era is fully pressing down on the gas pedal and just speeding right ahead into pop superstardom. EDM, wholly on this album, is tossed to the side in favor of a simple songwriting practice and crowd-pleasing radio hits. I think it's particularly evident on one of Smile's singles, the song Knock Yourself Out XD. Imagine an emoticon in your head. Knock yourself out.
I'm still processing the emoticon thing. XD is like a face, a laughing face. Capital X, capital D. I understand. Okay, now that that's out of the way, this track is kind of tender. It's giving me a little bit of like Owl City vibes, maybe.
Ooh, so true. So true. Very Fireflies coded.
Very Fireflies coded. Very sensitive. Very, very kind of beautiful in its way, even though it's still got that massive sound pulsing underneath. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like this is Porter Robinson shedding his Electric Daisy Carnival persona and leaning into full-fledged pop stardom.
Yeah, and you can even hear his voice clearer on this song and this album than previously in any of his other work. Though there's inklings of said previous work in what he's doing here, and that's one of the things that I talk about with him. But before we get into all of that, I did want to start by asking Porter about this line in Knock Yourself Out, which I think you're going to get a kick out of, Nate. Don't know my schedule on the 5th. Bitch, I'm
Taylor Swift. Got 100 million on my wrist. I don't know my schedule on the 5th. Bitch, I'm Taylor Swift. That's funny. It's like a decade ago, the Chainsmokers could say, I want to be Kanye West. Today, it's like, I want to be Taylor Swift. That is the paragon of success. And what a fun, unexpected line. I definitely need to know more about where this came from. So what do you think? Should we flip it over to you and Porter now and get more context on this Swiftian reference here?
Yeah, I'll let him take it away. And you'll find that this deeply silly line has much more thought than you could ever imagine.
Nice.
I'm Porter Robinson. I would most broadly describe myself as just a musician. Right now, I'm making, I would call it songwriting, pop songwriting. Yeah.
So let's start with a simple question. I'm sure you've gotten this a lot. I've been thinking about it for a few weeks. Bitch, I'm Taylor Swift. What does that mean to you?
So I'm like a Red and 1989 person. Like, I really like her most saccharine work. That saccharine actually has a negative valence to it. I don't like that. I really like her most. Like, I have such a musical sweet tooth. Mm-hmm. I love big, cute hooks and stuff like that. And I think that comes through in my music. And that's my favorite work from her. But what that meant to me was I was kind of writing this album, despite being somebody of kind of middling fame, about the pressures that I was feeling and the desire to both be consumed by it, but also to escape it. And at the same time, I was taking this approach towards songwriting where I was really embracing musical basics. I was really embracing cliche. So a lot of like chord progressions or musical moves that I had forbidden myself from using in the past, because they were like, you'll hear people joke about four chord songs in music discourse a lot. And I had kind of written those off for myself. And I embraced all of those things on this album. And so there was a lot of very Taylor Swift-y moves that I was making in my melodies and my chords. And I had just been thinking about her a lot. Like, it would actually be a genuine infrastructure problem for her to take a normal flight. You know, like I was reflecting on that. I was like, she has a degree of fame that's actually inconceivable to most people. And I think that she sort of takes a lot of flack for talking about those things. And I was talking about them as well. So that I was thinking about her a lot. Like, I see parts of myself in her, for better or for worse. And also, you know what the bigger thing was there? I was sitting down with an acoustic guitar on my childhood bed, because I wrote this album at my parents' house, and learning to play the guitar for the first time, trying to write songs with it for the first time, the words "Bitch, I'm Taylor Swift" came to my mind, and I thought, this is so stupid. But then I couldn't get away from it. It was like anything I tried to replace it with just felt weaker, and it felt less memorable and less like it was going to be screamed, you know? I was really chasing that feeling of something that would have that bigness and that catharsis and that shamelessness, you know? That's "Bitch, I'm Taylor Swift." My schedule on the 5th. Bitch,
I'm Taylor Swift. What better way to convey the like level of fame you're grappling with on the record than invoking the most famous person in the world?
That's definitely what was on my mind. It was like, the more I keep talking about somebody coming up and saying hi to me in the airport, the more I was thinking about Taylor. I was like, am I going to be compared to her in a really unflattering way? And my instinct on this album was like, anything I'm scared of being said, I'm just going to say it. I think I'm a person who feels a huge amount of self-consciousness and shame and all the above. And I started off trying to play this unashamed rock star character. And I think what ultimately ended up happening was it kind of crumbled as I was writing the music and I started telling the truth more and saying how I was really feeling. But it was, I was able to tap into it for a split second, you know, it felt nice.
Knock Yourself Out starts off the record. So was that your intention of putting it first, like putting this image out there that this is like what I am wrestling with on this record?
I was going to say it was the first song that made the album, but actually the song Easier to Love You, which is a bit of a ballad, started off as like a dance pop track right in the aftermath of the previous record, Nurture. But Knock Yourself Out was the sort of vision board statement. It was the thing that I made when I was just feeling the most like wanting to just burn it all down a little bit and wanting to start over and wanting to disappear and all the above. What kind of song would I make if I felt no fear, if I felt like there was no consequences, right? Like I talk about this a lot on the song Russian Roulette, which is there's like an economy around me now. There's like a bunch of people who I have on a salary and stuff like that. And my way of approaching music every single album has been like burn everything down and start fresh. I want to go somewhere new. I want to be standing in new creative fertile ground because that's the only thing that makes me feel that like vitality to like, I got to make something new. Like I got to make something that's like, I want to be somewhere else, you know? And Russian Roulette was me reflecting on how that's harder than ever now because there's a lot of people that I love that are kind of in my world and are relying on me, and like it matters now if my shit were to implode tomorrow. Best friend, we don't have to pretend. One day I could make you your salary. And I don't like that feeling, to be honest, but like yeah, Knock Yourself Out was me indulging that fantasy of like, this is so not a Porter Robinson song. That's how I was seeing it. When I first made it, I was like, this is so not a Porter Robinson song. Everyone's going to hate this. But this is what seems really fun to me right now when I'm toying with this idea of burning it all down. And I remember when I first posted, like, I was kind of like taking the JoJo Siwa school of music promotion because I posted the most like draggable possible clip of that song. And just kind of like let the like quote retweets roll in for 48-hour cycle. I like posted the "Bitch, I'm Taylor Swift" part, and that was it. Some interesting exposure therapy for me. I used to live in fear of like getting dragged, and then I was like, well, what if I thought about this as like a way of oiling the machine and turning eyeballs and stuff like that? And that fear of shame or that fear of being hated is a bit of a debuff for a musician. And I think that, like, for example, when Doja Cat was saying like, I don't love my fans, and her fan accounts were imploding en masse, I was like, man, her apparent fearlessness seems to really be serving her here.
That's why people love Doja Cat, because she talks so bluntly about her work and her career and her fans. Like, I think people connect with that in a way.
Right, right. It doesn't feel like it's been media trained. It doesn't feel like it's been like rehearsed, or like a TikTok team was like looking over it and being like, hey, like this is the optimal whatever. Like, so I wanted to tap into that energy, but I think there's this thing of, grappling against my own nature. And I think my own nature is that I am probably more on the side of introspective and thoughtful and careful and conscientious. But I wanted to see what it felt like to throw that away a little bit and be a little more reckless.
Well, speaking of being thoughtful, like, I was really taken aback by a lot of the internal modes of thinking on this record. Like the end of Russian Roulette, where there's the text-to-speech voice talking about how sonic cliches are beautiful.
The kick drum and bass suggests the song is coming to a close. That's the format we're used to. Cliches like this are beautiful because they reflect us, and we are beautiful. Take, for example, this chord progression.
The first time I heard that, I kind of just like sat back and was like, wow, can you talk about that a little bit more? How do you see that manifest in your work?
I'm glad that resonated with you. So like I said earlier, I was embracing cliche on this album. I was using the guitar for the first time, which is like the ultimate, in my view, it's the ultimate songwriter's tool. And I only learned like 3 or 4 chord shapes. Like, I didn't learn anything advanced, but it was enough for me to kind of feel a song emerge. On the left hand, I had the music, and on the right hand, I had the drums, the rhythm. And in that, I could imagine the rest, you know? But what that meant was that I was playing fairly basic stuff on the guitar. And in the production, too, I was like, I don't want to be at all head ass. Like, I wanted to get back to the things that are like these things that seem to transcend context. That must be a reflection of something deep inside of us. And I really do believe that human beings are beautiful and worthwhile and amazing. And so anything that seems to strike a chord with almost everybody in a positive way, there's a beauty in that. You know, I don't think that should be condemned. Okay, here's a great example. So I'm sure you've seen the videos of babies being shown the meow version of What Was I Made For by Billie Eilish.
Yeah.
And they're just like moved to tears without any lyrical context, without any... It's like how babies will instinctually see a snake and react in an aversive way, you know? I just think it's fascinating and it's beautiful. And I think like some parts of our nature can become invisible to us because we're so close to our nature. I wanted to basically wear this like embrace of cliche and no embarrassment, no shame. It's actually something that's beautiful and worthwhile. And I think it's something that a lot of the hyperpop world has done in a roundabout way before me. Like Gex, for example, they, I feel like, approached this in a way where, with perhaps a twinge more irony, they were like visiting, like, actually not just the most cliched things, but like some of the most reviled genres, like ska.
Totally.
And I guess one of my favorite things in the world is finding something new to love or something new to appreciate. Like, dude, we're all gonna die. Like, I think it's like the more things you can love while you're alive, the better. And so if anything can open my mind in a new way and make me love something, I find that just to be ridiculously valuable.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Looking to start a side hustle or become your own boss? Do it with Shopify. Whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify has the industry-leading tools to help you create, control, and grow your own business. So get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.co.uk/special offer.
Well, I feel like it's fascinating that, you know, on Smile, you're pursuing more traditional songwriting approaches when the record is contending largely with your relationship with fame. Like, you know, my first thought would be the natural progression to be like to step backwards, you know, into more abstract genres, abstract sounds. If, you know, the natural reaction to fame is to be uncomfortable by it. So what made you pursue this kind of full pop pivot?
Well, there's two things, because like, one, I'm reckoning with downsides of fame, but I'm also addicted to it. And that's just the reality, is it's like, I feel like that's something that people don't want to say, but it is true, in the same way that I'm addicted to like my phone or addicted to caffeine or League of Legends or the whole nine. Like, that is insanely addictive. And it's something I would miss if it went away, and it'd be hard for me to deal with if it went away. And I feel like I was in denial about that in public ways for so long, but it is true. So that's one thing, is I think that, like, I'm, to some extent, I was still pursuing success. But I think the much larger part of it is that my taste just changes over time. And I, like I said, I'm always looking for something new to love. And one of the things that was really starting to hit for me on this record was the rock music of the 2000s. Like, I never had really listened to The Killers before, for example. Somebody told me you had a boyfriend who looked like a girlfriend that I had in February of last year. I had never really listened to, like, Coldplay. I'd never listened to Radiohead or Nirvana. Like, I was always such an electronic music person. I hadn't gone deep on these things. And another weird micro thing that kind of hit me really hard was listening to the, like, Warped Tour era scene MySpace emo bands for the first time. I was like, wow, this stuff is really, 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 like, there's so much value in it. What's the worst thing? It was like I fell in love with this stuff through a lens that was not a nostalgic lens, because I didn't grow up with it. I was only listening to electronic music. And, like, there was just a new place that my taste had gone. And I was like, I want to get as close to the feelings that this music gives me as I possibly can. And my way of doing that is to try to embody it and to live it. Like, when I love music or any idea or aesthetic, I just, like, I feel like I need to drown in it. Like, I need to be so immersed in it that it's all I can feel. And when something inspires me to do that, like, it's like, I will know life it until I feel like I'm living it. And so for me, that was just like a lot of, like, rock and pop. I was like, I want to know what it feels like to make something in this genre that's great. Even if I wanted to alienate my fans deliberately, the creativity shows me the path when I'm in the studio. Like, when I'm making something, five options will emerge in front of me, and one of them lights me on fire. I don't really have much say in that. You know, like, I'll strum a certain chord and it'll hit me in a certain way and it just screams at me. It's like, it almost wouldn't have even mattered if I was like, I want to make something that all my fans are going to hate, because I think my only choice in the studio is to go down the path that just makes me fall in love. But it's funny, it's, this album has alienated a lot of my fans, and the EDM fans are not happy. But it's every project I've ever done feels to me like it's kind of underappreciated in its time, and then people tell me to return to it 3 years later. So I'm just very used to it at this point. Nurture and Virtual Self and Worlds, all of them at the time were met with ho-hum reactions, or that the thing that I did previously was better, that I need to go back to what I was doing before, why did I change? And at this point, it's just like, that's the most expected thing in the world. So,
well, like, the reverse of it, though, is that, like, I do hear inklings of your previous projects in Smile. I'm a big fan of Virtual Self. I saw the shows, like, I was really locked into that one. That's awesome. That's my favorite project of yours, you know, they're all
good. Oh, awesome.
I love Virtual Self. And when I was listening to Russian Roulette, there's, like, that drop towards the end. And I was like, oh, wow, this is reminding me of that EP, of that project. I was wondering, how do you see your previous work come through on an album like Smile?
That section reminds me of Virtual Self, too. Mm. It also reminds me of the music that I was making when I was 15. I had, my first alias was Eco Wraith or Echo Wraith. I don't even know how to pronounce it, but it was Eurodance, hands up. Music, like, similar to Bass Hunter, Cascada, anything nightcore. Mm-hmm. That was, like, what I was making when I was a teenager. In a way, the end of Russian Roulette, since I'm talking about life and death and wanting to see my family one more time and wanting to play my songs one more time, I wanted to sort of harken back to the very first musical output I ever had. And it, as far as how my previous projects are reflected through my music, I think this is weird. I kind of see Knock Yourself Out as having some Worlds DNA, and I don't know if other people see that besides me. But I think it's the fact that it's like every sound is as big as it can be, and it opens with this really clear hook. Like, it reminds me of the song Divinity from Worlds in a weird way, even though the attitude and the lyrics are so different. Like, something about that song makes me think about worlds. No one sees that but me.
Smile is a record that literally in the title, it's all caps, exclamation point, happy emoticon, you know? It's positing itself as this reckless, happy record, frankly, and has a lot of really contemplative, heavy themes. How did you conceptualize that juxtaposition? Did it come through as you were making the songs in the studio? Because it took a pivot in the middle of the songwriting process.
It did take a pivot in the middle of the songwriting process. There was the record that I wanted to make, which was this reckless, happy, fun album that was shameless and a nonstop party. I was like, I wanted to make Porter Robinson as fun as it could be. Mm. I really wanted it to be fun. I felt like that was missing from Nurture in some ways. There was the album that I was trying to make and then the album that actually emerged. I've blamed the guitar for this several times. Picking up the guitar, my emo side flowed really effortlessly. Mm. Something about even the posture of it, just the feeling of holding a guitar makes me feel dramatic. And it makes me feel like a poet. It makes me feel like the things I'm saying have weight and meaning. And so, yeah, I think all the somber, contemplative, introspective stuff was like, I kept writing songs like that, and I was like, okay, yeah, there'll be one or two of these on the record. But ultimately, it ended up being more like half of it. All of you, nothing else in the
room. This seems like it's everything to me.
But the title, Smile, it's not a purely positive thing. Like, somebody telling you to smile can be like a unwanted catcall, you know? Like, somebody telling you to smile is actually really unpleasant. And it has an exclamation point at the end of it. It's like this, like, demand in a way. Yeah, it's like partially a reflection on all of the teeth-related lyrics that are on the album. And it's partially a reflection of how I felt in the years leading up to Smile, where I was trying so damn hard to be like somebody worth looking up to, I guess, and somebody that people thought was a good person and somebody who was worthy of admiration and respect and all of the above. Like, I think I kind of like made myself into a caricature at times with Nurture, where people started really putting me up on a pedestal and acting like I starting to think that I had maybe more answers than I did. That was one of the things that I really wanted to shed. I was starting to get really scared of the caricature that I had created of myself. And that's why the album looks the way it does. It's this like perfect little cartoon guy that's getting squeezed to death is what it looks like. And I was like, I saw myself in that. So I was desperate, I think, to show some uglier sides of myself.
You know, I have a kind of a silly question, right?
Hit me.
The first single you released was Cheerleader. And to this day, I am hypnotized by that opening synth lead. Can you just talk a little bit about, like, what is it? How did you decide on that specific sound? Like, talk to me. Because I've literally tried to sit and parse what you're doing in the production to make it sound like that. Because it really just blows me away. It's this big texture.
Thank you. That's amazing. Well, I was, that day, I'd taken a long drive to a coffee shop and I was listening to a band called The Teenagers, and they were like an XL Recordings French band that was kind of doing like satirical American high school pop. And it's really, in my opinion, it's fairly half-baked. It's like pretty jokey. Mm-hmm. But I was like, oh, there's something to this that's like strangely beautiful. And I came home and I was like, I want to write something that has that kind of adolescent feeling to it. And so I like laid down the drums. I laid down like a bass line. I was like, I think this would really benefit from a synth hook. And that was in this time period where I was like, I want everything to be as loud and as bright and as huge as possible. I was pushing off of Nurture, right? I was like, I want this to be like a break the windows kind of sound. And I modeled it off of a lot of the synth lines you would hear in Eurodance, like German hands-up music that I grew up making, these really fat, brash, noisy supersaws. And I even want, like, there's a little bit of a, like, a technically, like, a slightly wrong note in there as well. Like, the synth keeps, like, bending and it's, like, pulling out of pitch. It's, like, that is, like, not really in key, technically. It almost sounds to me like a synth worm that's, like, thrashing and is, like, really unstable. I just wanted something that sounded like it was so big it was going to be breaking apart. So, I mean, I could further break down the sound design, but that's going to be on my Patreon for... But yeah, I mean, Cheerleader was like, it was one of those moments in the studio where I knew I really had something. There's something that happens in the studio. It's like one out of every 700 attempts of writing a new song, something will hit me and I will go, oh my fucking God. Like, it feels like a nuke just went off in front of me. Like, I feel like a song that actually does kind of hit, like Cheerleader, requires not just one breakthrough, but like six. Like I remember writing the verse for Cheerleader and feeling like, oh my God, like, I got two things now. I have this intro hook that's so good, and I have this verse that feels like really dancey and really youthful. And then I wrote the pre-chorus, and I was like, oh my God, this is so great. Where is this going? And like having three really great sections but not having a chorus, like, I'm sure you can imagine how terrifying that is. Because it's like, Now I'm building some kind of contraption or some kind of machine where all the weight is being put on this one point, which is this chorus that I have not yet written. And it's like, if I don't get this thing, all this other good stuff I just made is going to buckle. My God, I hope I can see this through and make it awesome. So it's like just this feeling of being certain. Once I made a certain sound, I was like, this is going past the finish line 100%. Like, no matter what happens, like, I cannot die until this thing comes out. I love that feeling. Making music is something that scares me endlessly. Like, I just because I care so fucking much and I want it to be as great as I know it can be. Like, it's like, I love it. Like, this is going to sound like a, like, Kanye statement and not the type of Kanye statement you might be thinking. So don't worry. We can air this. I really do wish that God could come down from heaven and just play me what my next project will sound like. Like, I think it would give me some clarity, actually, to hear my own music without context. I think I would really like it, probably. Maybe not. Maybe I'd be like, you overthought this shit, bro. I don't know. But I do dream about that sometimes. Like, I wish I could hear the next thing I'm going to make.
Switched on Pop is produced by Rihanna Cruz. We are edited by Art Chung. This episode was engineered by Bill Lance. Iris Gottlieb makes our illustrations, and Nishat Kurwa is our executive producer. We're a production of the Vox Media Podcast Network and Vulture. Vulture, in turn, is a part of New York Mag, and you can subscribe with a special link. It's nymag.com/pod.
You could find us on social media at Switched On Pop. And, you know, we're done with this series of newcomers, but there will be more in the future. So
I know,
tell
us. I'm kind of sad, Rihanna, that this little trilogy is coming to an end.
I know. But hopefully there'll be more in the future. So let us know on social media who you want to see in a newcomers interview.
We'll be back next week with our regularly scheduled Tuesday programming. Rihanna, I think we need to talk about a much beloved band that is reuniting after a 15-year hiatus.
Oasis?
Ding, ding, ding. That's the one.
Oh, incredible.
That's the one. We're going to do a deep dive into the Oasis catalog to help you find out if it's worth £1,000 and a flight to Cardiff to see the Gallagher brothers on stage again. And until then,
don't look back in anger.
Thanks for listening.
If you've been enjoying this podcast, here's a look into what else is happening at New York Magazine. I'm Corey Sikut. I'm an editor at New York Magazine. I'm talking with Madeline Leung Coleman. She's written for us about how we treat animals at the end of their lives, about the most difficult decisions that none of us ever want to make. And the big question we have is, who is this medical care for? Is it for them or is it sometimes for us? Hi, Madeline.
Hi, Corey. I'm really scared to talk about this topic on air because I don't want to start crying.
That is the big hazard here for both of us, that we will get very upset. As most people in America, we have had pets die and pets come and go, and it's tough.
It's true. And not only had them die, but had to make the decision about when they died.
You said that a vet said to you, like, 9 times out of 10, people have waited too long.
Yeah, she says of the euthanasia cases that she sees, 9 times out of 10, it's someone who's waited too long versus people who are bringing a pet in to be euthanized who she doesn't think would need it.
The phrase you bring up is a phrase we've all heard, which is the phrase, you'll know when. But we clearly do not know when, and both of us have not known when in our lives. Like, how should people who are struggling with this, like, know when?
There are actually some checklists that you can find online that basically help you evaluate your animal's quality of life. But ultimately, the only thing that actually prepares you to make the decision is having been through it before.
You were calling vets and pet owners and asking them about animal death and end of life and all this terrible stuff. What was the one thing you heard that surprised you?
The person I talked to who used to work at a shelter found that when people would bring their dogs in to be euthanized, people who really loved their dogs but just couldn't afford to treat them or just need to put them down for whatever reason, they would all bring their dogs the same last meal, a McDonald's cheeseburger.
You are kidding me. What?
Every single person, she said, basically would bring in a McDonald's cheeseburger for their dogs to eat.
I'm kind of upset. They can have chicken bones, finally. Just what they all want to eat. That's all they want to eat is chicken bones. Let them have them. That's Madeline Leon Coleman, and you can find her story on animals, ethics, and death in our print magazine in your own home, which you should subscribe to and receive there, or at nymag.com/lineup. That's nymag.com/lineup.